Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint recap from the Center for International Maritime Security. This week, Matt, Chris, and Grant are joined by Caroline Truman from the Fletcher School's Neptune Group. They talk about the Arctic, the European Defense Britain, Typhoon Haiyan, China, the Hudson Center's American Sea Power event, and Grant sounds terrible because he didn't bring a microphone. We are available on Stitcher Stream Radio, as well as iTunes and Xbox Music. Remember to subscribe, advertise, and generally make a nuisance of yourself until your friends listen to the podcast. We think it's a fine product, and anyone who says otherwise is a liar. Now, sit back and enjoy the show.
Welcome to this week's episode of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security.
The views expressed here represent the individuals only.
I am, as always, your host, Matthew Hipple, and I am joined by my co-hosts, Grant Greenwell and Chris Barber. Hey, guys, welcome aboard.
Hoorah, Semper Fi, acta non verba. Great to be here.
Good morning.
Perfect. And we are joined this morning by Carolyn. She is from the Tufts Fletcher School Neptune Group. Good morning, Carolyn.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Now, Carolyn, just to start out, it's a great topic in and of itself. Would you describe to us the Neptune Group?
Sure. We're a student group here at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy focusing on maritime issues. It takes a broad interdisciplinary approach looking at security aspects as well as environmental business aspects of maritime affairs.
Great, and how did you get involved in it?
So I've always had a maritime interest. I worked for a congressman who was a former Navy admiral, and one of the great things about coming to grad school is you get to really pursue those interests you haven't had a chance to professionally pursue. So I got involved, a fellow student here, Chris Peterson, and I got chatting, and this past summer I went with a group up to Svalbard, Norway, to the Arctic, to look at Arctic shipping.
It's interesting you bring that up. We had a week of Arctic affairs earlier this year. Did you guys have any cool observations from the Arctic, or was it just a fun trip to Gdansk and Norway and all sorts of other fun, really cold areas?
Well, I think it was great for us because the Arctic has become a very hot topic, but whether or not it will become a real security concern is very much up for debate, and whether it will become a major shipping route looks much less likely than we had previously understood. We were there with about 30 other researchers, mostly in the hard sciences, and what we found was there's a lot of general framework, but there are a lot of questions about implementation of how do we actually apply this now that the Arctic is becoming a more viable shipping route? And the Russians have certainly taken a very firm stance on how they think that things should look. I think there's definitely room for the U.S. to begin taking more of a role in the Arctic, but whether or not we will, whether or not we will build those extra icebreakers we need, remains to be seen.
Perfect. Now, what was that like going up there with just hard sciences people? So I'm sure that their interests and the priorities they had were a lot different than you. You're like, oh, I want to learn about the law. And they're like, oh, I'm sorry, I have to go take a core sample of this ice in the middle of this iceberg. Let's go up there on a helicopter. And you're like, oh, this sounds terrible. I'd like to go to a restaurant, please.
I want to caveat that with Hipple's usually unable to do any math above a fourth grade level, so he tends to go after those people hard. I have a lot more respect for the STEM individuals around here, but I'm sorry, Caroline, that's just to jump in.
Well, I will say we did get a chance to go to all four of the bars on the island, so those have been well sampled at this point. It was great. Here at Fletcher, I focus on the role of technology in international affairs, so a lot of what I do is about translating between the science STEM section and the public policy diplomacy aspects of it. So I really enjoyed it for that reason, and it was great to be able to discuss with them their perceptions of what foreign policy and activities in the Arctic should look like and be able to have a dialogue between them. So they're great. Always love hanging out with nerds. It's the best way to spend a summer, really.
Well, you are going to spend about an hour with some today, so that's good.
I got a question for Caroline really quick, and I'm just to caveat your focus technology-wise, and you're talking about the Arctic. So in your best professional judgment. Do you see, you know, whether or not we look at the Arctic as expanding due to polar ice cap melting or not? I mean, I think we can still say that that's a little bit fuzzy in terms of the what we view or don't view about it. But let's take it for a given. Now, do you really view the kind of the friction points to be more of the undersea resources a la South China Sea, or do you view it as something more in terms of freedom of maneuver, freedom of access, and controlling those shipping lanes? What do you see as the major friction point if we were to take it for a given that the Arctic will become a more transverse area for international shipping?
That's a great question. I think really I'd want to propose a third option. It's an issue of perception. That the Arctic is very much tied up into, if you take Norway, Russia, and Canada, into their national identities. So yes, there's an aspect issue. Yes, there is a resource issue, but it's a perception issue of asserting national sovereignty in those areas. Where the friction points probably might come are probably around the axis. We've seen the Russians take a very firm stance in asserting control over the Northern Sea Route. And that's probably likely to continue. So if there's more competition, if there are more people trying to bypass the Russians, not pay those pretty hefty fees to go through Russian waters, that would likely become a point of discussion. But I don't think this is going to become a hot conflict at any level. It's not the level of transport.
So the modality you would use to frame this would be akin to a Panama Canal or a Suez Canal type situation where somebody's going to claim some type of transitory ownership and you don't. I'm interested to see that because something that is a good modality for me to think it through. And then the other thing that I'm interested by is when I think of that the Arctic, and I'm very much an amateur in this, I don't know much about it, is you know, I look at what's going on in the South China Sea and kind of the rush to potentially exploit some potential mineral seafloor, mineral and oil and gas access on the seafloor. And I wonder, is that the same type of thing we would see up there or not? And what would drive that? If you're saying that, hey, it's more of an access thing and it's going to deal with transit rights, I think that's, you know, probably an easier way to deal with it. And I do think I would probably concur that, hey, this doesn't seem that it's going to go hot, but it does leave some real interesting problems for the cartographers and the map makers as how this thing's going to get split up and according to whom as we move on.
I don't think it's, I mean, all these countries, we see even Russia and Norway calmly negotiating their maritime borders. It's all going to go to the UN, and I think all the parties are very happy for it to go to the UN at this point. So we should be seeing a few decisions coming out of the Commission on the Continental Sea Shelf in the next few years on that, seeing where there's more data needed. Whether or not certain ridges will go to certain countries, yes, there are going to be probably a few disputes, but hopefully this will be a fairly technocratic process, and it looks like it's going in that direction. So, and in terms of will this become a Panama Canal, it is already a Panama Canal issue. Whether or not Canada will have their waters classified as passage or internal, not as big of a deal because that's not the really attractive route right now. But Russia's already asserted. You want to go through that area, you're going through Russian waters, you got to pay the toll.
Okay.
Perfect. I think this is a good entry since we're talking about territorial concerns and lots of points of friction between countries. This week, a series of articles came out. One with Scott Cheney Peters, our vice president, came out with How to Avoid War with China. I immediately came out with my rejoinder, How War with China Would Start. And then Zen Pundit came out with its own article. I think that the key sticking point was that Scott, his main contention was that a big way to avoid conflict was military to military communication and contact. I focused more on the aspect of conventional escalation, logistics, and mechanisms. Carolyn, do you see there being any issues with escalation in the Arctic over resources, maybe red lines that people might cross, or do you think it's pretty, this will probably stay inside of a courtroom?
I think it's going to be the latter, stay inside of a courtroom. Again, because all these countries have been going to the Commission on the Continental Seashelf, they're not really interested in and I put it this way, wasting resources. We've seen pig fisheries in the Norwegian High North. Russia and Norway came to an agreement. They recognized each other's interests. One of the things here at Fletcher we focus a lot about is let's move past the zero-sum game, let's focus on interests. And they really did this. And Norway said, listen, it makes sense for us to let Russia to fish here if we get to manage the fisheries. So if there are any disputes, I think it's likely we're going to see them in the diplomatic realm and the legal realm rather than in the security realm.
Now, Carolyn, have you done any research or study on the South China Sea?
Not as much as I would like. Professor Perry here does teach a course on it that I have not taken, and I kind of wish I had right now.
Ah, well, that's all right.
Don't worry about it. We're all just amateurs grasping at straws.
Exactly.
So I really wouldn't concern yourself.
I did study in China for a number of months back in undergrad, and one of the recurring themes I remember hearing from people was, well, of course this is Chinese. It's always been Chinese. We just have never had the ability to assert that. There's that mentality that's very hard to shift in the Chinese psyche about these territorial disputes.
See, you're already more of an expert just by that. To get to the escalatory thing, I'm on board with you that I don't see the Arctic, no pun intended, becoming a hotspot as you would in some other places. I do think that there's probably some interesting dynamics we can take from that and seeing how that works and how effective or ineffective the UN is in parceling that up and comparing that to the South China Sea. Because as you look at the Philippines and what they're trying to do with the treaty, I think it's the UNCLOS treaty, and what they're trying to do via international law and court in order to counteract the so-called cabbage strategy of China, regarding going onto these small shoals, establishing presence, and then essentially equating presence to sovereignty over time, I think you could probably see some interesting dynamics that could be transferred over there. But how effective that works, seeing as obviously they're very different in the human dimension. The Arctic is still not a gigantic human dimension in terms of traffic, land-based presence, things like that, whereas the South China Sea is one of the most trafficked slices of water on the globe. I think it's going to be some interesting stuff.
Well, in that region, we've got a fundamental difference that in the Arctic, there are relatively few states that we're talking about, and they're fairly big. In the South China Seas, we've had China say, we're not going to deal with these countries. I believe there's a statement about, yes, there's ASEAN, but we're going to deal with you all individually, which gives China a whole lot more negotiating power in this than they would have.
I am also in grad school, as Carolyn is now, and one thing I do want to confront her with is the wonderful ability of grad school students not to stake their flag anywhere. So I do want to give Carolyn a couple of hypotheticals. Worst case situation in the Arctic, what would lead to a shooting war? Go as crazy and in the left field as you want. Best case scenario, what would be the, hold hands and everybody's happy and what would lead to that? And then if you want to throw us one in the middle, but you got to stake your flag. Who's going to be the prime, kind of malfeasant actor? Who could be a positive actor or who can't?
Chris, are you talking about the Arctic or the South China
Arctic,
Sea?
Arctic right now.
That's a good question. I mean, we can hypothetically go back to the Cold War and try to say if Cold War tensions resurfaced, got Russia versus North America, and that the Arctic would become a proxy. And I think that's the most likely situation regarding the Arctic, that it's a proxy for something else. You want specifics, and I'm not sure you're right.
No, you don't have to go into specifics. Just don't be afraid to say, hey, what would be the kind of left of boom actions that would lead to like a Sovereignty class cruiser being sunk to the bottom, and or a U.S. ship, Canadian ship going down? What would lead to that very bad case that nobody wants to see?
Yeah, and then I would definitely say it's proxy, and we might even see it as something happening up there, proportional response to something else, that we would rather not have that proportional response happen in a more populated area.
Okay. how much, like, what do you see as the basic kind of day-to-day operating look of the Arctic having to change? I mean, in terms of number of ships, number of commercial ventures, number of government ventures going out there and working to create, how much would that have to grow compared to its current state right now?
That's a good question. And I don't think, are you saying for it to be accomplished?
Well, I'm saying to just, you know, what type of trends, overall large scale trends do you think would need to increase to result in that worst case scenario?
And I would say no difference at all would have to happen. If it's a proxy for something else, we've already got ships up there and, it's just going to be a matter of opportunities. There's probably going to be an increase in shipping, but I don't think targets would be necessarily civilian up there. But moving on to your other side, what the Kumbaya scenario, I think we're already seeing it, especially between Norway and Russia. There is a strong move to cooperation that is in both countries' mutual best interest to cooperate around these areas. And we'll see what further guidelines are going to come out in the Arctic around Arctic class ships and such. You know, it'd be beautiful to see search and rescue become much more established, much more unified in that area. But we're already moving in that scenario. I'm relatively optimistic. We might see an increase in, I would say, like a NATO-like force. We see an increase in joint operations and joint exercises in NATO. I mean, the Russians are still flying planes over Norway, asserting themselves in NATO. Is trying to assert itself more in the Arctic, but yeah.
Does that NATO-like force include the Russians in your best estimation?
I think it will be a while before we see that happen.
Okay.
So speaking of opportunities where good smart power missions and humanitarian missions like search and rescue did not quite get accomplished by all parties, I think we saw an interesting thing develop this week with the Philippine typhoon that came in and all the powers sending their ships, sending their assets, whether that be monetary or naval powers, or choosing not to do so. You have any thoughts on that, Matt?
You beat me to the segue. I was going to go from the escalation to preventing war as important as winning them. What I think is really important is people wonder, hey, is the Pacific pivot working? If in fact, you know, there is even a pivot to the Pacific, because a lot of folks would argue we're already there, and as for what's changing, it's really not much. It's more of a public affairs of tone. But for the Philippines, when people talk about who's the real power in the Pacific, means actual presence, is that it's still the United States by a very, very long shot. And really the reason for that is this typhoon comes through and who's the person on the ground? It's the United States. Not even just through our naval presence and through the amphibs going out there, and you got CBs and Marines on the ground, but you've also got Team Rubicon. A few of us in SimSec have been talking about them, and that's really awesome. It's a lot of veterans volunteering their time and active duty as well to go on these relief missions, sort of like a Red Cross, if the Red Cross was filled with only people who used to carry around guns and wear a uniform. The best part about the U.S. response is that it was typical. And I think that's what's most important here. No one is surprised at the U.S. response. The U.S. response is accepted as the norm. And although appreciated by the people receiving that aid, I think that's the most important part, is that the powers in Asia, the people watching Asia, don't see this U.S. presence as a surprise. It's the status quo. So you wonder, okay, China may have a large number of ASEMs, and they may have some control over the second island chain, but who cares? Because at the end of the day, when a typhoon comes through and wrecks everybody's house, the United States Navy is the one that's there, and I think that's what's important.
You know, the thing that fascinates me is China's lack of response to this whole situation. They had a tremendous opportunity to really, one, strengthen ties with the Philippines, but two, assert their influence over the entire region by sending one of their six different types of hospital ships down there. They chose not to. I understand why they didn't send their ARC-class ship simply because it just returned on deployment. But they still had a lot of other assets, both monetary and naval power to do it, even sending a team of doctors down there, and they didn't. And it's a shame. You know, as much as they go ahead and they say that they want to push out to the first island chain and really kind of be the dominant factor over there, to not only to go ahead and assert their influence, but also to ease the U.S.'s commitments in the area, they completely abdicated on that by not getting themselves involved. It'll be interesting to see what happens in the coming weeks as we build up a bigger presence with doctors, with humanitarian aid, you know, potentially having a lacking presence for HADR efforts in the Philippines if China tries to get back into the game.
Yeah, I just to jump in here really quick. So I think your points, Grant, are spot on, and I think it's very interesting that when you have a country that is literally trying to shove another sovereign nation off of a bunch of rocks via some pretty aggressive means down in Scarborough Shoals and other places to force them into a situation where they are, you know, they're literally a very short hop, skip, and a jump away of helping a lot of people and establishing some goodwill and then forcing them to really confront what their true motivations are in that area. It's kind of an instance that you can't always be good, but sometimes you can be lucky. And that's kind of the situation that we found ourselves in right now. And you know, not to make light of that horrible ecological humanitarian disaster in the shape of the typhoon, but it does afford the United States a very, very great opportunity to kind of make China speak much more loudly through its actions than its words. And that's the type of thing we have to be able to continue to do in that area, which is only going to be done through a really strong joint Navy Marine Corps team. I don't think we're going to get that ability anywhere else, and it's something we have to account for as we look at these budget battles coming up. So that to me is the most interesting part of the equation, is that you have an actor claiming that they're super benevolent and they're just looking out for their own interests and their own sovereignty, and they don't want to mess with anyone else, you know, which is obviously tongue-in-cheek, grain of salt type of stuff. But when the rubber meets the road and they have the ability to affect some pretty positive actions via soft power, which is something they're proclaiming they're building up, you see what really happens when they're confronted with an antagonist over an issue and trying to help them out. So,
you know, go ahead.
In Scott's article this week, he referenced Panetta saying that, you know, besides going ahead and building up, you know, a force that can counter any of our peer rivals in that area of the world, the more important thing is to develop relationships that are going to prevent that, because you're not going to get into a bar fight with one of your good friends. It's just not going to happen. And so even last month when we held out in Hawaii, joint operations between China and the U.S. For humanitarian aid, relief operations, we chose not to flex that in this case, which is just a shame. I thought we'd made a lot of good strides and steps over the past few years in anti-piracy operations, doing a lot of joint things with the Chinese. It'd be nice to go ahead and further develop that relationship so that we are, as we like to say, peer competitors. You know, emphasis on the peer. Make sure that we're doing operations that are going to stabilize the different regions that we both cohabitate. And this was just an opportunity missed on all of ours.
I was reading the Christian Science Monitor, and they had a photo in Tacloban City. It's the statue of MacArthur and his team coming back onto the shore. And that city was also hit, and pretty symbolic here is you've got the figures, and one of them bent and now is on the ground because of the winds. I think that's particularly symbolic, and the way I hope and I think that a lot of our partners in the Asian Pacific view U.S. interests in the air area. We are that strong security military presence, but just like that statue, our interests are also in the area. So the hurricane hits, we're the ones that come to the rescue, but we're also in it with them. And I think that's the important issue, is I don't necessarily think that the Chinese are viewed in that way, or even the Chinese view themselves that way. When they look at these issues of sovereignty, yes, they want to play the game when it comes to taking territory and taking control and expanding their EEZ. But when it comes to natural disasters in the area, do they really consider themselves part of the neighborhood, or is the neighborhood just part of the background noise as part of a greater program? I would say it's probably the latter.
You know, and Felix actually submitted a really good article about how even though it's kind of far away, Germany needs it to have a greater stake in operations in the Indian Ocean. I think that has really good ties over into does the U.S. still need to assert influence in the Philippines area of the world, or should we let regional actors do that? What are you guys' thoughts on Felix extrapolating that to what's going on in the Philippines now?
I like any time Europeans have to pay their own defense bills. So it seems to be something they haven't been doing much of. So anything that encourages that, and if we go through the more soft power realm to kind of have them build up some capacity, I'm all for it.
I gotta say I'm on board with that too, just because when it comes to the Pacific, it makes sense. There is a peer competitor in the Pacific. It makes sense for the United States to be there, but there are lots of places, that the European powers could fill in the gaps. There's already Operation Atlanta. Is that, maybe I'm saying it wrong. I think there might be an extra A in there. Atalanta. That it throws me off every time. That's not necessary at all. Just call it Atlanta, or, you know, Atlantis. Atalanta. That's unnecessary. You're just messing with me now. But yeah, Operation Atalanta in the IRTC. Those are good missions, and they're kind of on the peripheries. But when it comes to the big ticket items that really need to be dealt with, I'd say the Pacific and on the land side, Africa are big concerns. And when it comes to those maritime issues in between, you talk about the Indian Ocean, and we also had that article by Matteo this week on the migration issues across the Mediterranean. Those are great areas for the Europeans to fill in. Caroline, we haven't – yeah, go look at that. I don't even need to say anything. You're already jumping in.
Well, and I think this is it's a question that Germany needs to decide in general. There was a report by Brookings that said that this is a critical moment for Germany. It needs to decide, is it going to step up on the world stage as the European superpower, even though the Brits and French might like to also have that claim. It's got the economic might doing pretty decent compared to a lot. So what does its leadership role, what should it be? And we've often had a suspicion of Germany still from the world wars. I've heard a lot of jokes about that the wiretapping of Merkel really shouldn't be viewed as so surprising, considering that last time we did it, there was good cause to. But yeah, I think we need to move past those old frameworks of thinking of the Great War and the Second World War and start saying, okay, we've got Germany as a modern partner. What should that look like? And we really need to step up.
I'll take a little bit. I don't think World War II, World War I, kind of the evil, spiky-headed German archetype really dominates it anymore. Maybe it does for some people, and, you know, I'm not European. I've been there several times, but I do think that that's something that has pretty successfully been moved past. And I think it's the important part of it being moved past is that, hey, Europeans, it's not so much that archetype, the World War II, World War I, it's the Cold War one that I don't think Uncle Sam needs to be the guarantor of European security anymore. You have a common market, you have the EU, you have a lot of different things, that should necessitate them taking a more active role, with what's important to them so that we can stop getting the slings and arrows being thrown whenever something happens that they don't like, and then more so, we can stop getting the bills thrown our way when there's something, you know, that they do want done, a la Libya or some other issue that's of more pressing concern to them. But I think that they pretty well moved past that. That's just personally me kind of pontificating with no real moral authority or ideological strength.
Every now and again, I was really struck by I went out and saw John Oliver last night, and he was joking about the wiretapping on Merkel that, well, you know, we've got World War II. that I agree with you in a lot of ways. It's been moved past, but we do need to find ways where we need Germany to step up, and we need Europe to step up in a sustainable way. So how do we do that in an age where Britain and France are shrinking their forces because of austerity or budgetary concerns? And I think the soft power way of reframing Germany might be the way to do that.
And I'd say for a large part, a lot of us might be surprised. I remember a lot of professors talking about that internal dialogue in places like Japan and Germany about the war heritage. It's just surprising to hear the responses from some people. I had a professor who taught security studies, and his big sticking point when we talked about Japan, I realize we're talking about Germany, but there's a corollary there, was that the passionate responses he got when he was talking about reforming the Constitution, about pacifism, and some people were just, they were not interested. Now, these people were middle-aged and older, so maybe their memories are a bit different. The new generation hasn't inherited that sense of the sins of the father, but I couldn't speak to Germany, but I have heard that strong narrative where they still remember it could have become part of the national culture or dialogue, much in the same way that a lot of Americans talk about American exceptionalism. A lot of us take that for granted, but I think that perhaps when we talk about a change, it might be a bigger deal than we might make it out to be. Now, I know they're both obviously reforming and changing, but still, it's something worth thinking about.
Well, and do you think that's why we see, I mean, Japan pledged a substantial amount for the Philippines. We've got Germany and Japan, they like to engage in more humanitarian missions, but are much more reluctant to engage in a more hard security realm.
This leads us to a good point where we can talk about combat fleets came out, a new edition from USNI. And we talk about partnership, we talk about Germany and Japan, we talk about what their interests are, how they work more in a humanitarian way. Something that Eric brought up during the speech that I think is an interesting way to look at this is that combat fleets used to be a French book, and then they did with USNI an English edition, and now there's two books. They are not necessarily competitors, but they're obviously pushing for each other's market share, but it's different interpretations, different ways of looking at the world, and it's really neat to see that sort of partnership that he has, Eric has, with his French counterparts when it comes to making the English and French versions, the two models of the book, a good way of looking at the way how we do business, and for the most part, we're all on the same team, which I really enjoyed seeing. So, who got a chance to see any of the material on the Hudson event this week? The Hudson Institute opened up their new shop on Sea Power.
I actually did not see the event. I read the transcripts afterwards, and I was shocked to see the following day Admiral Perry from our Friends Across the Pond was actually referenced in a couple of my battle scenarios the very next day. And it was very interesting to see that he, you know, 5-10 years ago when he was, you know, still running the fleet out there, how he was proposing that we, one, go ahead and gather all of our allies together and try and see what the strengths are of the different states and apply those smartly compared to what he was saying at the forum this week.
I enjoyed the conference myself. I thought something Admiral Perry and Admiral Harvey brought up, and we will be having Admiral Harvey on the podcast, which will be excellent. The two of them definitely were speaking to the choir when they talked about the importance of sea power. They talked about growing trends like environmental change, Admiral Perry mentioned in particular, that would make maritime affairs far more important. But the issue I think both of them failed to deal with is that it is very easy to go in front of a group like the Hudson Institute that's interested in sea power, that's interested in maritime issues. Even the title of the effort itself is Sea Power, not Maritime Security. So there is sort of a bias, a good bias, one that I agree with, by that exists there about what we should do about maritime security. But the problem is that you wonder how you would communicate that to, especially in the United States and other countries as well. If you have Europeans that are already using the security umbrella of the United States, how do you make to them the argument, like in Germany, you say, hey, you need to send ships and start stationing them out in the Indian Ocean. It's a little different than the narrative. In the United States, you have issues with growing youth movements, both on the same sides of a different coin when it comes to military affairs. You have libertarians and you have progressives. Libertarians and progressives on the same page with that, they wonder, why do we have so much defense spending and how do you communicate that? I didn't see that, and that's a question that I haven't answered for myself, but that was something that I worried about, is that we haven't answered, we in the community have not answered that question yet. But I did like, as always, Brian McGrath was there, and he jumped over that question. He said, fine, I'm not going to be able to argue the budgetary issue with anyone, so what do we do? And Grant, he went very much with that narrative that Admiral Perry, you were describing, has used in the past, and he said, well, hey, we need to learn where to specialize and which fields. We didn't get to ask him a question about which fields he would recommend, but when it comes to BMD, it comes to aviation, it comes to amphibious assault, littoral operations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, is that if we continue insisting that we do everything, then we will become like the British Navy, which is essentially a very, very, very small baby version of what it once was, which doesn't have really the power to punch really hard in any arena, which becomes an issue. Do you want one carrier strike group that just drives around the world, or do you want, for one example, a possible horrifying future for pilots where there are no carriers and there's just destroyers and amphibs, and we've just chosen to cut one major limb off to save the rest of the body? If we couldn't get funding restored, or if funding continues to drop, how that would look.
For all our aviator friends up there, realize that's two SWOs wanting that future.
I did not say I wanted it.
I'm sure that would upset the balance of the cool guy quotient of who got whatever colored shoes you guys wear at the bar.
As a pilot myself, I definitely go ahead and sympathize with pilots feeling that they may be getting cut out of the equation with strictly carrier force. UAVs and such as that, but I definitely think that there's a future well into the next 100 years for real life human pilots that are not based in Connex boxes in the middle of the desert. But Brian always does a really, really good job of getting very specific in his comments. Besides looking stellar in a bow tie, he's very good about saying, you know, this state has this capability, we need to flex this while we can back off of this. You know, I think one example he gave during the conference was minesweeping capability, and how potentially we need to look at the U.S. Backing away from that and letting our other nation and partners who do a better job of it just exclusively do that. And when we need them, we call them and potentially put the bill for it. And, you know, one thing that he didn't say is, you know, my personal belief is that's the only way that we're going to be able to sustain the naval influence that we have now. We're not going to be able to do it with a 11, 12 carrier force. Too expensive, too big, too much world.
It sounds like sea power, it's very military. Why was there any discussion at all in this about our mercantile fleet, about the commercial side of which builds American power in the world?
Grant, my memory is a bit hazy. Obviously, I concentrate on the military angle. I do believe that it was brought up, but I won't lie. The focus that I had when I was there is I was thinking about force planning. So my memory on the merchant fleet we were talking about hasn't been retained as well. If maybe you can talk on that, having done the readings.
No, I know specifically one we didn't talk. They didn't talk about U.S. Merchants really contributing to one, economic power, but to smart / soft power in the region, which is something we definitely need to be doing. You know, one thing we were talking about earlier, and I don't want to bring it back up, but Arctic, you know, it's not going to be a military function. It's certainly not going to be naval powers going surface action group versus surface action group out there. It's going to be shipping and keeping the sea lanes open, which is what, you know, the merchant fleet was when it converted over into a naval fleet back in 1776. And, you know, that's one thing that we really need to keep looking at, is keeping the sea lanes open. You know, really, are we looking at, as Admiral Perry was saying, you know, are we looking at the sunset in the West? and I think we could be, as far as naval forces are going. Yeah, we do need to have a military presence, but we also need to make sure that our shipping keeps up, because that's what's going to keep our economy strong.
You know, that was what I liked about Admiral Perry, Admiral Harvey, and Brian McGrath, all their points. Someone brought up during the question and answer session, they said, hey, isn't about the this about the sunset in the west and the sunrise in the east? And Brian McGrath brought up that, hey, we can talk about China's Navy all we want, but it's useless to me, because at the end of the day, I have to know what I have. So we need to get our house in order before we start talking about someone else. Now, of course, you have to inform yourself as to what challenges you want to face, and many of those are the threats like area denial posed by the Chinese Navy in a potential conflict. But still, it is important to understand what you want your missions to be and where you're going first before trying to apply it to future challenges. But I did think on one of your points, Grant, is that Admiral Perry brought up that freedom of the seas is perhaps hyperbole, but only in a small way. Freedom of the seas is the basis of Western civilization. Freedom of trade, freedom of the seas. And I think that was absolutely important. His concentration of his point was that the most important security issue for any one base security issue for people dealing with maritime affairs is keeping the seas open, because that's the basis of our global economy and the way that we live our lives. And there's a surprising number of circumstances in which, as we talked before, we talked about the Arctic as the giant Panama Canal, which it's called the Arctic Ocean, not the Arctic Huge Canal. Is that that's applied by freedom of the seas. And if people start talking about tolls in the Arctic Ocean, that sets a disturbing precedent for possible tolls in other areas. You know, I wouldn't foresee this happening, but the Straits of Malacca, imagine if a toll was imposed there. Bad precedent when it came to dealing with innocent passage and ships being able to travel.
So I just want to jump in here really quick, because it's in a very near and dear wheelhouse to my heart, and Carolyn mentioned the merchant ships, and I don't know exactly what you were referencing, Carolyn, if you were talking about just more use or more numbers, but really we can affect the numbers of U.S. flag merchant ships transiting around the world very easily internally, because the reason we've seen the United States merchant marine decrease to the number that it has is largely because we have one of the most onerous regulation schemes in the world, and that's why business has transited to some of these foreign flag vessels and these flags of convenience. So I think that's probably one of the better things we can do if we want to increase just the presence. I will say, being a licensed mariner who never actually sailed on it, going straight into the Marine Corps, but a Kings Point grad and a licensed mariner, I don't always buy into the merchant ships as a huge sign of presence, a la what a carrier battle group or an ARG or something like that does in terms of presence, because it's a very different dynamic, having seen it on the ground. You know, I don't know how much when I was a mid at Kings Point and we delivered I was on a ship delivering some of the first foreign aid to go to Sudan, to Darfur. And even with every bag having an American flag on it and it being an American flag vessel, I really don't think that still equated to the same type of presence in the mind of those Sudanese that an armed vessel would have done. But there's something to be said economically for the ties that bind kind of deal and what we can do with that. But again, I think the biggest answer to extending U.S. flag merchant presence around the world more is to look at our regulation and to look at our incentives that we put or disincentives towards U.S. flagged the U.S. flag vessels.
Carol, I'm actually interested. How would U.S. flagged merchant vessels be viewed as a presence? Maybe that's and I'm kind of going along Chris's same lines here. Is how does a commercial vessel, which can be crewed, Chris, you've encountered as a merchant mariner, can be crewed by almost anyone. It's not like immigrating to the United States. I think the employment restrictions are a lot less. So it could be anyone on the ship. How does someone really view that as a presence? Or is that sort of a theory that's being thrown out?
My question comes from, I think there's often, it's very easy to make a distinction between the security side and the commercial side. And usually the two of those are linked. I mean, if we look at the British Empire, that's how the British Empire grew. It grew through that linkage of the two. So I was more curious about whether if the Hudson Center was making a distinction and trying to stay in the security realm, or if they were seeing them as a part of each other. And with that, I agree. Like, there's nothing like a carrier group to signal presence. It's going to make a huge impact compared to the commercial side. But in terms of building relationships, I'm curious if there is a discussion about the potential for trade and the commercial side to make an impact.
Go ahead.
Sorry, let me jump in. I think there very much is a discussion, but the problem is that area of the world being kind of the net exporter and us being more of a net importer, until we make a concerted effort to redesign regulatory bodies and regulatory actions, that commercial presence is going to be foreign flagships coming here, because mm-hmm. That's just the economics of it, and it's not going to change. Because for business, you're not gonna send it on a U.S. flag ship because of the cost. Vice what you're gonna send on another one, another flag ship. So I think that's very much part of the discussion in the commercial linkages. But if we're trying to grow those commercial linkages under U.S. flags, your math problem is just not gonna work out until there's some changes done with how we look and approach stuff.
I'd also say probably when we use the example, which is good, the spread of the British Empire via trade, is that in those days, due to the nature of communication using the sea lanes, is that it was probably specifically because the people on the ships, the people doing the trade, were in many cases agents of those companies and of those countries, whereas today the guys on board Maersk have no particularly strong loyalties to any one particular company other than Maersk, of course, or any particular product, or necessarily see themselves as institutions or agents of, you know, the British Empire or whatever country they might represent. Because today we use the internet, today we use cell phones, today we're able to communicate across continents in an instant, is that a lot of that investment that's put into the authority with those guys on the ship really isn't there anymore. So that maybe doesn't mean as much as it once did. I would say that's probably the case when it comes to trade, is that maybe we're overshooting ourselves when it comes to looking at the merchant fleet as necessarily a wing of presence.
That's great.
Just I think we're hitting the top of the hour here, not to steal Matt's thunder, but I wanted to hopefully go through what's on our radar for the next 5 to 10 days, what we're looking at. Kind of we usually do a weekend's reading or a next week's reading or an event schedule for SimSec. So maybe verbally we can just talk personally about what each one of us are looking at. And for me, I'm going to say the things that are very much on my radar, that the topics that I'm interested in looking at, is specifically how, as we develop the Typhoon more and we see what's gone on there, the effects that has writ large and what we read off in China. And then also, I think for all of us, is as these budget battles continue, those are the two big things that I'm looking at. Every week you can see little bits of tea leaves, if you're checking kind of the industry, websites and publications and such, to see what we're really looking at. So those are the big things I'm looking for.
Grant, how about you?
Yeah, if I were to choose 5 things to do in the next week, on Wednesday, Brookings is holding a conference, Taiwan and Trans-Pacific Partnerships. I would hit that up, followed closely by the DC chapter of SimSec is having a gathering that night over drinks to discuss what happened. The following day, Hudson has a response to that in the form of Taiwan and the U.S. shared strategic interest. So I'd go to those three things. And then I would listen to two different podcasts that came out over the past 24 hours. The first is by King's College, Department of War Studies. They've got one on PRISM and Snowden and electronic eavesdropping and stuff like that. I'd listen to that. It's about 22 minutes worth of information. And then Brookings also put out one on Israel's economy and security and how that affects recent changes in the military. The week after, though, two big events. Cato is doing rethinking in U.S. nuclear weapons policy. So I think that's going to be a big summary of kind of what we've read and written ourselves in the past month. And then also the following Monday, King's is doing one on Russia's influence over the Caspian Sea.
Carolyn, what's on your mind?
Well, I, other than regular grad school work, I think I've just gotten some great suggestions for what I can be doing this week. So I think I'll be taking a look at some of these.
Perfect. As for me, I am probably just going to be showing up to my new job and be worrying about that pretty much exclusively. But, guys, it has, as always, been a pleasure. Carolyn, do you have anything that you'd like to plug? Maybe your new group has a Twitter handle or a publication they come out with or something you think we should be reading?
I would like to plug affiliated with the Fletcher Neptunes group as the Institute for Global Maritime Studies. They do have a Twitter handle, INTGMS, and you can check out their website at Google or IGMS.org.
IGMS.org. And how do you spell that Twitter handle? I didn't get that.
If I'm going to get this right, INTGMS.
Got it.
Somebody taken IGMS, so we had to be a little bit creative.
Perfect. Chris, Grant, you guys, I got anything you want to throw at the back end?
Read my article from last week. I'm not as prolific as Hipple, so when I do say something, it's more powerful. And just say no to unification.
Bingo. Got it. Grant?
Go ahead and check out our events page, simsec.org/events. Also follow us on Twitter at simsec. We put out daily reminders of what events are going on. And if you have something that you want to be observed, recorded, pontificated on, please go ahead and shoot us a note, operations@simsec.org.
Absolutely. Let me repeat that for everybody. If you have anything that you would like to talk about, if you'd like to come on the podcast, if you've got issues you think are important, email any one of us. Chris is membership@simsec.org. Grant is operations@simsec.org, and I am nextwar@simsec.org. As always, you can find us at www.simsec.org, and as I rail on every week, you can find us on iTunes and Xbox Music if you would like to subscribe, and you can also now subscribe to us on Stitcher Stream Radio, so multiple venues to follow us and listen to our mindless meanderings on security issues during the week. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, again, that is @CIMSEC, and it has been a pleasure. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, guys.
We're off.